Thank you, Bob, for sharing that. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Lon. And it's truly by God's grace in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have not found it necessary to take a drink since October the 8th of 1984. So the 8th of this month, I just celebrated 30 years. I know a lot of you are wondering. I sobered up when I was 3. You know, anytime I share in a meeting, I pray ahead of time and I ask God to really kind of clear my mind. And sometimes you got to watch out for what you pray for. You might get it. Kind of got a clear mind. I want to thank Deborah for asking me on Monday. Thanks for the advance notice. It's truly a privilege and an honor anytime I'm asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. And thanks a lot. The committee's just been wonderful, been gracious. Thanks. Now, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we're supposed to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. You know, I got into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 22 years old. And in 1984, at 22 years old, I was living in Arlington, Texas. And I went to a meeting and I looked around and I remember thinking, man, what is a high stepper like me doing in a dead-end outfit like this? Every one of them looked alcoholic. Every one of them. Everything I had imagined in my mind, there it was. So I really wasn't excited. You know, I went to some meetings and, you know, you guys used to talk about this one day at a time thing. And I knew you were talking about forever. I mean, because you guys had talked that you've been sober a long time and you've been going to those meetings. And I'm thinking, life is over. Life as I know it is over. And really, thank God it was. You know, going back when I was born, I don't know if I had anything to do with it. I was born with the umbilical cord around my neck. I don't think that made me an alcoholic, but I think it led up to a series of suicidal tendencies that would last until I was 5 years sober. I was the youngest of, I had 3 older sisters. My dad was a 20-year Marine. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. The first couple years of my life, they had this war in Vietnam going on. My dad was over there, and so I was just at home with my sisters. You know, the first thing I remember is really being angry because we used to go to church every Sunday morning. And my sisters got to wear these really nice, pretty dresses and carry these really nice purses. And I was the only boy, and I just cried and cried and cried because I didn't get to carry a purse to church. I mean, it's important you understand that in the early 60s, it really wasn't as popular as it is today. So my mom wouldn't let me do that. I don't know that any event in life made me an alcoholic other than drinking alcohol. I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've done a lot of inventories, and I've come to the conclusion that drinking alcohol had a big part to me being an alcoholic. But there were a lot of things that happened growing up that when I took that first drink, it seemed like it became a solution for all my problems. I mean, it just felt like everything felt right when I drank. I enjoyed the feeling. I was always one of those kids growing up where, like you often hear in meetings, I didn't really feel like I quite fit in. I kind of felt like I was on the outside of the bubble. I might be close to the bubble, but I just always felt on the outside. But man, when I drank alcohol, golly. Gee, man, I could dance, my zits fell off, I could talk to the girls, I was outgoing, I was funny. And then when I wasn't drinking, I was insecure and just totally engulfed in self and what other people thought of me. You know, I really don't want to get into a lot of outside issues. The first thing I did wasn't really drink. I started whiffing gasoline. I started working on a mini bike in the garage, and I started smelling it. It smelled good. And I worked on that thing for about 2 years. Then they had that gas crunch in the early 70s, odd, even days. And got to be a real hassle. It was easy to steal it from my mom. Probably up until I was about 10 or 11, my mom didn't even drink. My dad did drink. mostly outside the house. But after my dad retired from the Marine Corps, both of them started drinking. In no time, my mom became kind of this full-blown alcoholic. And I remember thinking, when she drank, she was just whiny and, oh my gosh, just a wimp. And I used to think, gosh, I don't ever want to be like that. You know, when my dad drank, he was like this real angry guy, and he wanted to fight. And I was, man, I just don't want to be like that. And I thank God I didn't turn out, I turned out like both of them. I was kind of an angry wimp when I drank. I like to start fights and rarely win them. But you know, my mom and dad had split up and I was living with my mom. My older sisters, one had got married, the other was off to college, and I was probably in my teenage years. And I remember hating the way my mom drank. She drank vodka because you couldn't smell it. And I used to take her vodka and I used to dump it down the drain. And she'd come home from work and just be furious because I would fill it up with water and she'd have about three drinks and she's pissed off. And then I thought, what a waste. So I started pouring into a little flask of my own. And kind of drink here and there. I was probably in high school when I had my when I started getting blackouts. I really didn't know they were blackouts. I kind of believed it. I think I got blackouts when they first come out. I really didn't know what a blackout was, but I knew the next day there were a lot of events that happened that I thought I was passed out during, that I had friends that would inform me of all the wonderful events that I participated in. And I really thought I kind of passed out wherever I woke up, where I came to. And then they kind of explain a lot of the stuff that happened. I don't know how I made it through grade school, high school. I graduated from high school. I remember thinking, I got to do something. I got to be something. Didn't know what I'm going to do. And I said, you know, I'm going to go talk to the Marine Corps recruiter. My dad was a 20-year Marine. I'll see about being a Marine. And I went and talked to this recruiter. Man, he had these VCR tapes. He'd stick in there, and you got to watch this little television of making a Marine. And I'm telling you, man, when you finish watching that thing, you're signing up. I thought, man, that's what I want to be. And I signed up, and I got into boot camp. And I got to tell you, if you ever watch those videos, it's nothing like it when you get into boot camp. Those guys were not nice. They just yelled and screamed a lot. I kind of felt like I was at home. There was a lot of yelling and screaming. And, that 3 months was probably the longest period of time I was without drinking. Graduated from boot camp. And I like this service. I like the Marine Corps. I like the Marine Corps because if you're alcoholic like I'm alcoholic, when I drink, people tend to notice things that happen around me. And when you're in the service, if the sergeant and major gets to know your name or the CO gets to know your name, it's usually not a good thing. And I never got in trouble while I was at work. It was always when I was out in town. And it would be something where I passed out and I ended up in the hospital or I passed out and I ended up in the hospital. And sometimes I would pass out and end up in the hospital. So my medical record was getting really, really big. But I liked the Marine Corps because I was going to school and the service, you move around a lot. And I like moving around because about the time things got tight, people started, you know, in your name, you got orders somewhere else. And you got to start this thing all over again. And so that's what I did. I kept starting it all over. But every time I went to the new place, I really believed. I thought, man, this time it's going to be different. This time it's going to be different. And I would get to that new place and I would continue to do the same things. Eventually I got kicked out of the Marine Corps for alcohol abuse. There were a lot of events that led up to that. Like I said, my medical record was getting thicker. I was in, I remember I went to, I think it was Jacksonville, North Carolina. I went to Memphis, Tennessee and Cherry Point. And then I went to California. And I remember I got orders to Japan. I thought, that's what I got to do. I got to get out of the country. It's a country that's causing me all these problems. I get to Japan and I get there and I start drinking. And man, the same stuff starts happening again. Except this time I'm far away from home. No family's around. Of course, I already let you know about my real tight family. And you're missing that kind of real tight alcoholic family. And I started getting depressed. And then when you're depressed and you start drinking a depressant, you really get depressed. And that's kind of how I was all the time. I was just really depressed. But there were a lot of good things that happened when I was in the service. I went to Korea, Operation Team Spirit. Really enjoyed it. Got a 96-hour pass. We got to go to the Philippines, me and a buddy of mine. And he drank like I drank. And me and him started drinking one night. And both of us went into a blackout. And we came to. You know, when you're in the Philippines, Filipino people are... Well, they look Filipino. And when we came to, there really weren't a lot of Filipino-looking people around. And so we were curious what might have happened. And I remember my buddy went up and he asked somebody, where were we? And a guy said, Richardson. And I said, Richardson what? And he said, Richardson, Australia. And then in the early 80s, you could catch military hops with a 96-hour pass. And evidently, we got into a blackout and caught a military hop to Australia. And we were pretty freaked out. And we had never caught a military hop before, so we had to ask them, well, so how do you get back? And they said, I'll just go through the same procedure you did in getting here. And I'm thinking, man, if I start drinking, no telling where we're going to end up. But we got back to the Philippines, didn't really get caught, was in within the 96-hour pass. I went back to Okinawa and feeling this depression. And I was a lance corporal, and I was drinking with a staff sergeant, which is kind of a no-no. But I was drinking up at his barracks. And I drank about a six-pack of beer, and I'm just dying inside. You know, just dying inside. I don't know what's going on, but I walk on this outside deck, and I'm looking over the flight line, and it's just a quiet, calm evening, and the wind is blowing, and I feel like it's blowing right through me. And behind me, there's this bicycle. And on this bicycle was this bungee cord, and I took this bungee cord off of the bicycle. And I was on the second deck, and there was a rail, and I hooked one end of the bungee cord around the rail, and I hooked the other end around my neck. And when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I told you guys that I jumped off. But I want to be clear, I really kind of eased myself down. Because I'm thinking, man, if I jump off and this thing breaks, I can hurt myself. I mean, I want to die, I don't want to hurt. So I kind of eased myself all the way to the bottom, and unfortunately, my tiptoes were like touching the bottom. And you know, you can pull them bungee cords so tight and they just won't pull anymore. Well, that's how tight this thing was pulled. And it was just pinching the crap out of my neck. And I had to get enough slack, so I was trying to hop up a little bit to get enough slack to get this hook undone. Because at this point, I'm thinking, life's really not that bad. So as I'm trying to jump up and down and get enough slack, this staff sergeant walked out of the bottom deck and he said, what are you doing? I mean, what do you say? You know? Oh, just hanging around. And at that time, the military thought that I might have a problem with alcohol. So they sent me to Long Beach, California, at the Naval Regional Medical Center in Long Beach, California, and I go to treatment. I'm 20 years old in California. The drinking age is 21. First thing I heard when I got to treatment is, fake it till you make it. And I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't even drinking age. That was ridiculous. So I went through their program. I went back to, I couldn't believe they sent me back to my problem. Sent me back to Okinawa. I was sober about, I wasn't sober. I did not drink for about 6 months. They had put me on Antabuse when I got out of treatment. And I had to go to the gunny's office every morning. He'd give me an Antabuse pill. And after about 3 months, 4 months, he handed me the bottle. He said, just continue to take them every day. And I said, no problem. But I did. I really did. I took them every day. And one morning I got up. It was a Friday morning. I thought, you know, after work, I am going to grab a 12-pack. I'm going to go to the seawall. And I'm going to have me a drink. And so I didn't take Antabuse that morning. Grabbed a 12-pack after work. Went to the seawall. And I started drinking. I didn't know it takes more than one day to get this stuff out of your system. I got to tell you, I started drinking, and I was drinking with a buddy of mine, and he's looking over at me like freaking out, man, because I got these like really red blotches that are starting to pop up all over, and I mean, you kind of feel like you got the hives. I kind of had a hard time breathing, and then I started throwing up. I'm thinking everything's back to normal because that's kind of the way I drank, but I really, in no time, I got really, really sick, and I realized, okay, we've got to give this stuff a couple days. I give it a couple days and started drinking again. The doctor that saw me, that sent me through treatment, saw me at a place called the Beer Gardens drinking, and he said, we're going to kick you out of the Marine Corps for alcohol abuse, and that's what they did. Kicked me out of the Marine Corps for alcohol abuse. And so you go back to your hometown, and everybody knows you're in for a four-year stint. It's about 2 years later, and you're saying, well, we had kind of have an agreement, you know, that I didn't need them, and they didn't need me. By this time, my mom's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what an unbelievable big book that I read through her. Unbelievable. She used to ask me if I wanted to go to meetings. And I didn't need to go to meetings. I had it all down. I wasn't drinking. I was doing some other outside issues, but I knew alcohol was causing me problems, so I wasn't drinking. My dad calls me up in Texas. He says, hey, I've got a job here if you want it. I said, that's what I got to do. I got to get out of Jacksonville, Florida. So I moved to Texas. When I lived in Texas, well, I went to work for this company where we made beer bottle caps. So I had to start drinking for job security. So I started drinking, and when I lived in Texas, I'd probably been put in jail more times in Texas, all of it for public intoxication. You know, the insanity from the disease in which I suffer is pretty well described in this following story. I used to go to this place called The Strip in Grand Prairie, Texas. If you're not familiar with The Strip in Grand Prairie, if you're not familiar with Grand Prairie, Texas, it's in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. If it was a body part, it would be the armpit. It wasn't a real glamorous place to live. But I would go there every Friday night. And I would get drunk every Friday night. And I would get put in jail every Friday night by the same bouncer. And the same cop would arrest me. And the solution I brought came up with was, in Grand Prairie, Texas, a fine for public intoxication is $28.50. And the solution I had was, before I went drinking on Friday night, I stashed $30 in my wallet. It never occurred to me that maybe I should not drink. It didn't occur to me maybe I should drink somewhere else. None of those thoughts occurred to me, and I really remember thinking, I got them. I got them tonight. When they put the cuffs on me and take me to jail, I'm laughing on the inside because I stashed $30. But there's probably 30, 40 times that I was put in jail for public intoxication. You know, I hit a point that everybody who hits a point who comes in Alcoholics Anonymous hits, and I don't know what that point was, but it was just that point where just the book describes the feelings. I mean, reading the book and it were in the description of the alcoholic. That was me that it talked about. That was me. And I remember it was pouring down rain. And I went outside to a payphone. We didn't have cell phones. Didn't have a phone in my house, my apartment. I couldn't afford a phone at my apartment. But I called my mom, collect, to Jacksonville, Florida. I call her up and I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And she said, Lon, she said, I can't help you. She said, if you want help, you need to call AA. And she hung up. I'm thinking, man, whatever happened to weak hair? I was really wanting to send me some money or something. But that was on the 6th of October. And on the 8th of October of 1984, I walked into my first meeting. And I looked around. And like I told you, I wasn't happy about it. I was thinking, man, we got to do more of this crap tomorrow. I didn't like the way they held hands and they were hugging, kissing, they pinched my cheeks. I was kind of the youngest, probably the closest one to my age was probably at least 18 to 20 years older than me. And I remember looking around and thinking, oh my gosh, this is it. This is it. A lot of the elderly ladies, they were really nice to me. They used to tell me to keep coming back. Now, if you're new and you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a lot of things that they told me when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous that they may tell you today or they may not tell you today. A lot of the stuff they told me, they shared it, that was their experience. And if I tried to follow their experience, then I might have a chance at this thing. But they told me to start out, remember they said, make 90 meetings in 90 days. And wow. I started going to 90, it was about 2 weeks and I realized, I remember counting after about 2 weeks sober, I told my sponsor, I said, that's a meeting every day. A little over the top, isn't it? But I did. I went to 90 meetings a night. They said to get a sponsor. A sponsor, I believe, is real important. A sponsor's my definition of a sponsor, he's the guy that comes in after the war is over to bayonet the wounded. I mean, my sponsor was not a nice guy to me. He told me the truth. But see, I think a sponsor is real important. I think a sponsor is important because that's a person that I have in my life that I can be accountable to. They can give me feedback. And as I go through this life, they're constantly giving me feedback. And I really kind of relate it a lot to the shuttle. When we used to launch the shuttle, you know, they'd have Houston Mission Control just constantly giving the shuttle feedback, making little adjustments. And that's kind of what a sponsor does. It gives you little adjustments as you're going in this trajectory. You know, what would happen if I didn't call my sponsor? What would happen if I didn't let them know what was going on? What would happen if they launched the space shuttle and in 90 days they go and check on it? And if you're like me, I'm going to be way over at Uranus. Way off course. So a sponsor is real important because he gives me that feedback. Gives me that guidance. I had a sponsor that was real involved in service. He got me involved in service. I didn't know you had a choice. A lot of times people say, oh, you want to do this service? But I didn't have a choice. I didn't know you had a choice. I really didn't. He just said, come on, we're doing this. Okay. And we'd go. And you hear in these meetings, oh, if you want what you have, I don't know if I wanted what you had. I knew that I didn't want what I had, and I was willing to do whatever I could not to have what I had. And when I wasn't at work, I was in somewhere involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at meetings all the time, and he would drag me to these things. And service work, I got involved in early on, and I got to tell you, if you're not involved in service work, I was about two or three weeks sober, and I remember I went to an 11 o'clock meeting at my home group. I might have even been a little bit more than that, maybe a month. Month and a half. But I went to my home group, and it was an 11 o'clock meeting in the morning, and nobody was there with a key. I hadn't been sober long enough to get a key, but nobody even showed up with a key, and I called my sponsor, what's the deal? Nobody's even here with a key. How do you expect me to stay sober if nobody shows up to these meetings? And that's when he informed me there's more than one AA meeting in Arlington, Texas. He said, Lon, they got a meeting right up at Central. And this was a Saturday morning, and so I drive over to this central group, and I go in there. Now, I'd never been to one of these kind of meetings before. I knew it was a different meeting. But I got in there, and everybody's sitting in there, and what they were having was a group conscience. But I didn't know what a group conscience was. So I go in, and I'm sitting down, and it's a little bit different than an AA meeting. I think there was a lot of deaf people at that group conscience. A lot of loud information passing. It was something to do about the electric bill. And then some old boy gets up and he shuts off the lights right during the meeting. And another old boy, a little bit bigger than him, get up and he turned the lights back on. And they went off and on for a couple of times. And that big old boy hit that little old boy, bam, right in the mouth. And I thought, man, I love these group conscience meetings. Now I'm telling you, I don't like missing group conscience meetings. I don't like that. Now that doesn't happen at every group conscience meeting. But if you don't go to them, it may happen. These are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going to happen. So if you don't go to these things, you don't know. You may miss it. But I was excited. I was fired up. I left that meeting. I called my sponsor. I said, man, we got to do this service thing. This stuff's interesting. And you know, if you're involved in service, there's really just a small percentage of people that really make this thing work. There's a small percentage of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that make this thing work. And I kind of liken it to going to I live in Jacksonville, Florida. I kind of think of it like going to a Jacksonville Jaguar football game. It's really very much the same. You got 70,000 people in desperate need of exercise, yelling and screaming at 11 people in desperate need of rest. You get involved in whether it be at the district level, the area level, at your group level, in conferences. That's what it is. And it seems like the ones that holler the loudest are the participants. But I got involved. I got involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor took me to these district meetings. He took me to the area meetings. We took meetings into the Union Gospel Mission. We took them into treatment centers. I had a blast. I had a blast. I was a couple weeks, maybe a couple months sober, and my sponsor said, hey man, on Friday nights, Lon, said, you got to come to the 8 o'clock meeting on Friday night. Afterward, we have some unbelievable fun. I said, well, what do you do? He said, you got to come. I'm not going to tell you. Golly, I'm 22 years old. I'm excited. Something fun to do on a Friday night. I'm looking forward to it. So I go to this meeting, the whole meeting. I'm just waiting for the meeting to be over. And the meeting gets over. And I said, all right, man, what do we do? And he said, Long, we all go to Denny's after the meeting. Wow. I'm thinking, I can't take much more of this. Are you kidding me? This is what I have been hoping for all week. But I went to that Denny's meeting, the meeting after the meeting. And after that first one, I got to tell you, I didn't miss one for a long time. Because that's where a lot of the healing took place for me. The meetings after the meetings. And people sharing, there'd be 15 or 20 of us, sharing their experience of life, of sobriety, of how they live these principles in their life. It's amazing. It was amazing. And if you're new, they talk about, it's not written anywhere, but they talk about, don't get into a relationship for a year. My sponsor said that. I didn't find any literature to dispute it or affirm it. I just believed them. But understand, when they tell you that, that doesn't mean at a year, bam, something's going to happen. That's what I heard. I heard at a year, she is going to show up. So a year came, and I told my sponsor, I said, okay, got a year sober. He said, well, God's getting her ready. Holy smokes. 2 years sober, I asked him. I said, all right, where is she? He said, well, God's getting her ready. Oh, my gosh. Now, during this time, I got involved in young people's and started getting involved with the Young People's Conference, the Lake Whitney Conference that Bob and Marcy White started. We used to have a conference every 3 months, and people from all over Texas would be involved and would come to this Lake Whitney Conference. It was awesome. It was an awesome experience. But I remember 3 years sober, I come to my sponsor. I said, all right, where is she? He said, well, God's getting her ready. And I said, you know, I have worked these steps. I've gotten involved in service. I've done the deal. I've been plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous. And if it takes God that long to get her ready, I don't know that I want her. And that's when he informed me. He said, well, maybe God's getting you ready. Ooh. You know, he says, you know, Lon, he says, you know how sometimes some guys will get together and talk, and he says, how we can line 10 women up, and we'll pick the sickest one every time? I said, yeah. He said, women do the same thing. He said, they line 10 of them up, and they pick the sickest one. And he said, aren't you tired of being the one being picked all the time? Because I was one of these guys early in sobriety that I liked dating. I didn't like long-term commitments. I had this unrealistic expectation of who this girl was going to be. And I would date a girl for 3 or 4 weeks and say, no, it's not her. And I'd date a girl for 3 or 4 weeks and say, oh, it's not her. And my sponsor pulled me aside and he said, you know, Lon, he said, girls that go around and they sleep with all these guys. So they call them sluts. He said, but guys that go around and sleep with all these girls, they call on these macho stud dudes. Yeah? And he said, well, you're nothing but a slut. And he said, if you don't change your behavior, nothing's going to change in your life. I'd love to tell you that I said, okay, and I changed my behavior. But I heard that, and it really didn't sink in for a couple more years. I got to tell you, the next couple years in sobriety, I was 3 years sober and I'm wanting to die. I'm 4 years sober and I'm wanting to die. And it's not like I wanted to die the whole time. I would get into this deep depression for 2 or 3 weeks and just want to die. I was 5 years sober and I'm playing Russian roulette with a 357. And me and Tom were talking about it. Tom a great story last night, but me and him were talking about it. And I came to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where I felt like I was too well to be sick. And I really couldn't talk about that I wanted to die. I ended up talking to my sponsor about it. I sold him my gun. That's what sponsors do. He got a good price on it. But at that point, I realized that I had to start doing things different in my life. I had to start changing. I bought this, you know, I'm sober and I'm not spending all my money, wasting all my money on this, on just drinking and all that stuff. So I ended up buying this brand new truck. The first new truck I had, it was a 1986 Chevy Silverado pickup truck. Now, in Texas, that's a sports car. It was red. And every week, I would buy something new for this truck. Because this thing, I mean, I bought wide tires on it, and I brought the chrome wheels, and I got step boards along the side, and they had a chrome grill you could buy. I bought that thing for the front. It's a little chrome thing on the hood. It had these chrome rails that went down the side. Got this chrome roll bar with the lights on top, and got windows tinted real, real dark. And it was looking good. I mean, I got a wood grain dash installed in it, and I got this little tiny steering wheel. It was a sharp-looking truck. And one Saturday morning, I remember I get out, and I'm washing this truck. And I spend 4 hours washing this truck, waxing this truck, shining, doing everything, just getting this thing really looking nice. And that's a summer day in Texas, and I thought, I want to go drive this thing around, because it's really important that you guys see what I look like driving my truck around. As I'm driving my truck around, I remember it was hot. Oh my gosh, it was so hot. But I had real dark tinted windows. I had to roll the windows down because you couldn't see who was driving if I'm driving with the windows up. So I got the air on high. Man, I'm looking good. I mean, I'm driving in stop and go traffic so you can get a good look. It was just so hot and the air's blowing on me. And as I'm looking, and I'm giving people give me thumbs up, saying, man, that's a nice looking truck. We stopped at lights and like, yeah, I like that. And I said, yeah, thank you, thank you. Then I started looking at the inside of the truck. Man, the inside of my truck, I really didn't spend a lot of time on that. I had McDonald's bags and Wendy's bags shoved underneath the seat. And my dashboard was all dusty and my ashtray was kind of overflowing and there was ashes all over the carpet and cigarette butts dropped on the carpet. And as I'm driving down the road, I thought, man, this is my life right here. This is my life right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. See everything on the outside to blow you away. And the inside, I'm just all trashed out. That's exactly what I felt like. And it became real to me at that moment. Man, my insides are trashed out. And I got to tell you, my involvement in service helped me go through a lot of these depressions that I went through. But in step 8 of the 12 of 12, it talks about how we got to go far beyond those superficial flaws and get down to the basic flaws, the flaws that changed the direction in my life, in our lives. And that's what I had to do. I had to start changing behaviors in my life. I had to start doing things different. And when I started doing things different, I started feeling better about me. See, for a long time, I kind of used service as that. Because if I did all these things and I could get that affirmation from you guys, then I would feel okay. And it worked for a period of time. And then you get in these modes where, like, I bought stuff for my truck. Or then you go and you buy the right clothes. And I had gold necklaces. Oh, my gosh, I had gold rings. Oh, I had gold necklaces. I hardly even hold my neck up sometimes. And I put them all on. I'd go shake people's hands and I'd have 4 gold nuggets and a diamond. Hey, how you doing? Because see, that's where I got all my worth from. But then when I took all of that stuff off, you know, and you realize you got holes in your underwear, you got to do something different. And I ended up changing sponsors. I got this other sponsor that was unbelievable and just in giving me the truth. Tell me things I really need to hear. And helping me change my behaviors. You know, when I started doing that, then the things around me started changing. I was 8 years sober, still living in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Now, being involved in service, I really enjoyed being involved in service because I could go to just about any group in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex and I knew somebody. Because when you go to district meetings and area meetings, you see these people. So you can go to these different groups and you see somebody at the area meeting or you see somebody at a district meeting. And so it's nice to really know people. And all of a sudden I decided I'm going to move to Jacksonville, Florida. So I moved to Jacksonville, Florida. And I got to tell you, nobody knows me. And I was not happy about it. And I tell you, the way they did AA down in Jacksonville, I was surprised. had some of them stayed sober as long as they had. You know, AA is very much the same everywhere, but it's very different. And I got there, and man, of course, my mom was sober for a long time. Her name was Betsy. And so, as I went to these meetings, people would say, "Oh, you're Betsy's son." Well, no, I'm Lon. But I got to be known as Betsy's son everywhere I went. And I remember I was living there about 3 years, and my mom said, "Lon," she said, "somebody come up to me and said, hey, aren't you Lon's mom?" She said, "I think you finally made it." But I was in Jacksonville for about six months, and I was going to meetings, and not many meetings, and I was not liking it. I was calling my sponsor and telling them how wrong they did it here in Florida. And after about 2 months of calling him, he said, "Lon, you better learn to do it the way they're doing it there, or you're going to get drunk." He said, "You need them. They don't need you." Well, I'm proud to say that I changed. The AA is pretty good in Jacksonville today. I don't think there's any place like the place that you sobered up. I just don't believe that. Nothing's like the place that you sober up. But what I did is when I got to Jacksonville, after about 6 months, I jumped in with both feet just like I did in Texas. And I got involved. I got involved with our inner group. I got involved with the home group. I got involved with the district. Got involved with some conventions. And I just jumped in again with service. I got married. I found Miss Wright. Turned out it wasn't Miss Wright for a long period of time. We were married about 6 years. I had a son. And she was sober about 5 years, and I guess I was sober about maybe 10 years when we got married. And she had started using prescription drugs and battled that for about 3 years. And she ended up leaving. I did get a son out of the deal. I fought for custody, and I got custody. And then I was freaked out because I was used to going to meetings. I was used to being involved in AA. And all of a sudden, I'm a single dad, and I've got a 3.5-year-old son at the house. And I got to tell you, I'm not one of those guys that I didn't bring my kid to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there were a lot of things said in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, I didn't think needed to hear. But I didn't know how I was going to do it. How was I going to not go to meetings? How was I going to be a dad to my son? And I tell you, God's got an unbelievable plan. I ended up, my mom watched my son on Monday night. I had sponsees come over on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And my mom's husband at the time watched my son on Friday night. And that's what I did for meetings. And every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I had sponsees come over to the house. We did step work. And it was amazing. It was amazing. My son's 19 today. I did not marry since I've gotten divorced. He's never been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's really a pretty good kid. He doesn't drink. He's 19. I guess he's not supposed to drink, really. But he doesn't drink. He just graduated from high school. He's got a job, a really good job, that is end up going to pay for 2 classes per semester for him to go to college. I just started, just recently started dating a girl. Her name is Pat. She's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, it's well worth the wait. I think for a long time when I had my son, I remember thinking how I didn't want women going in and out of his life. And so I really didn't date a lot for a long period of time, just because I didn't think it would be healthy for him having these women going in and out of his life. And then there came a point in time where I think that once he was old enough, I forgot how to date or something. I didn't know what happened. I can't tell you how grateful I am to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I told you my mother was sober for a long time, and she sponsored a lot of girls in Jacksonville. And I actually had bought a house on 2 acres, and then I split the property, and her husband built a house next door. And about a year after they built the house, he passed away with cancer. And my mom couldn't afford to stay at the house by herself. And so I ended up selling my house and bought her house and built a mother-in-law suite onto her house. And she was getting up in age and figured, you know, she could live in the mother-in-law suite. And, you know, she had agreed. But, of course, when all the transactions went down, she said, well, can I stay in the house a little bit longer? So I ended up having to buy the house and move into the mother-in-law suite. But about 3 months after I moved in, she was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia. And they gave her 3 to 6 months to live. And I got to tell you, I didn't know how she was going to respond. I didn't know how she was going to react. And it was the most unbelievable thing. The success rate with any type of treatment was less than 2%. And so she didn't want to do chemo. She said, you know, I want to be around the people I love, and I want to love the people I'm around. And I just don't want to be sick up until the day I go. And one of the things she taught me is to have no regrets. Because I got to tell you, she lived for 3 more months, but it was the most unbelievable living I've seen a person do. She was the most unbelievable woman. Stayed active with her sponsees. She died on a Sunday night, and that Friday night, she had about 40 of her sponsees and other girls come over to the house, and they had a bonfire meeting, and they had a sleepover. And the next day, she had went to sleep, and she had never woke up. But during that time, I tell you, you guys circled the wagons. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous just flooded our family with love. There was 150, 200 people just in and out of the house all the time. And that night, Sunday night, she, in her sleep, stayed asleep, she just passed away. But so many times, I remember her talking to her sponsees, and her sponsees crying, saying, I don't know what I'm going to do. And she was assuring them, you know, and she was the one, it's okay, I'm going to go to the better place. Things are going to be all right. I'm going to the better place. And I remember me and my sister really didn't know if my mother really understood what was going on when the doctor first diagnosed her. And she said, oh, I fully understand. And she said, you know, I've had a wonderful life. I've had a life beyond my wildest dreams. And she said, I'm just going to continue to live life. That's all I can do. And that's what she did. So she taught me how to live in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she taught me how to die in Alcoholics Anonymous. What an amazing woman. In closing, there's a couple of stories that I want to share. One is, actually, it's one story and a little quote. A story is about a little 5-year-old boy that goes up to his dad, and he said, Daddy, he said, can we go outside and play with my trucks? And Dad said, not right now, son. I got a lot of things to do. Don't bother me. And about 2 minutes later, he comes back and he said, well, Daddy, can we go outside and fly my kite? And he says, look, son, not right now. I've got a lot of things to do. Don't bother me. And he leaves. And about 2 minutes later, and he says, well, Daddy, can we go outside and ride my bike? By this time, the father's furious. He says, son, I told you, not right now. And he takes this world map that's on his desk. He takes this world map and he tears it up into a whole bunch of little tiny pieces. And he hands it to his little 5-year-old son. He said, look, son, he said, you get that map together. When you put the map together, me and you'll go do something. The little boy goes off in the other room and he calls his dad. About 2 minutes later, his dad goes in and he's got the map all put together. Father says, that's amazing, son. That's a map of the world. When you're 5 years old, how did you get that map of the world together so quick? And he said, well, Daddy, he said, on the back of this map, there's a man. And when you put the man together, the world goes together. And you know, that's what you guys taught me. I didn't like living in this place for a long time. And once you guys showed me how to put me together, that's an awesome place to live. And in closing, there's a quote from Paul Claudel that I heard early on in sobriety, and I want to share it with you. And it states that there's not one of my brothers that I can do without. In the heart of the meanest miser, the most squalid prostitute, and the most miserable drunkard, there's an immortal soul with holy aspirations. Deprived of daylight, they worship in the night. I hear him speaking when we're speaking, and I hear him weeping when we're praying. They need us all, and we need them. And just as there are many stars in the heavens, and their power of calculation is beyond our reckoning, we need them all in our praise of God. See, there's not one living being, even though he may scarcely give forth his light, that we do not need in that sacred apex where we utter together, Thee, our Father. Thank you, guys.